My name is Susan Hurley. I'm a former medical researcher and writer based in Melbourne. For this issue of NGV magazine, I wrote about the natural phenomenon of murmuration after being inspired by my encounter with Tsai Guo Xiong's work of the same name. Vagabonding in the More Than Human World. My journey into the world of starlings and beyond begins one winter morning at the National Gallery of Victoria. I am there to see and sketch an installation, part of a new exhibition. 40 people have signed up, and the gallery has opened an hour early just for us. I've seen images of the work on Instagram, so, primed for delight, I scoot past the ancient Chinese artifacts in the first few rooms of the show. My haste is rewarded with a solo viewing of 10,000 black porcelain starlings hovering above and around me in a white room. I'm not religious, nor prone to describing experiences as spiritual, but being alone in this large, silent space with this proliferation of birds feels like a Zen moment. Even the installation's title, Murmuration Landscape, is beautiful. Murmuration. It evokes the whooshing sound I hear when I hold a shell to my ear, a sound that soothes, even though I know I'm hearing the echo of ambient noise, not the sea. A murmuration is a flock of flying starlings, but these gallery starlings, each suspended from the ceiling by two fishing lines, are stationary. Nonetheless, the sense of movement is there and strong. The birds enter the room at one end and head for the far wall, which is concave like a church altar. There they fly from right to left in a jagged formation, the landscape of the installation's title. Our sketching tutor says the formation represents the Chinese mountain range that overlooks the burial tomb for the Qin Dynasty terracotta warriors, eight of which I shamelessly disregarded en route to this room. From the far wall, the birds move to the centre of the room to create a swirling, cloud-like mass. Underneath, we sketchers gaze up. The artist, Tsai Guo Xiong, a theatre director by training, is good at conjuring awe. I sit on a stool within arm's reach of the landscape and try to draw a bird. Tsai has created 100 different shapes. Some of the birds fly serenely ahead, others turn or soar or swoop. Before they were hung from the ceiling, the white starlings were packed into trenches and sprinkled with gunpowder, which was then ignited. Such gunpowder explosions are a signature technique of Tsai Guo Xiong's. A few birds turned out ink black. Most are a mottled mix of the black spectrum, an effect that enhances the aesthetic, but which I find difficult to depict with a 2B pencil. I leave the gallery needing to see a real murmuration. Starlings don't live where I do, but there is YouTube, so I'm able to watch murmurations happening over Rome's train station, Ireland's lakes, and Cornwall's marshes. It seems that thousands, sometimes millions, of starlings congregate at sunset throughout the Northern Hemisphere before they roost for the night. For around half an hour, they fly in formation, arranging themselves into distinct shapes, sometimes orbs, other times oblongs. Then they suddenly change direction, thousands of birds moving as one. The shapes pulse. A flock separates, then coalesces. In the videos, starlings look cheeky with mischievous eyes, pretty birds with purple and green iridescent feathers. Filmed from a distance, they're black specks, occasionally flashing red when their feathers are lit by the setting sun. They could be iron filings, their movement directed by an invisible conductor waving a magnetic baton as she dances across the sky. There's something primeval in a murmuration's twisting and turning, something grand too, and the videographers haven't resisted the temptation to substitute stirring music for the rustling of the bird's wings beating in unison. Pachelbel's Canon is a favourite. Finally, the birds form a dense mass over their chosen roost and drop to the ground as one. It's bedtime. Why are these little birds putting on such magnificent shows? And how do they bring it off without crashing into one another? The NGV label for Murmuration Landscape asserted that the phenomenon is beyond full scientific comprehension. I want to understand what scientists know, even if their comprehension is partial. Wikipedia gets me started. I learn that murmuration is a self-organized collective behavior exhibited by many animals, shoaling fish and swarming insects, for example. And although it looks to me like there's a conductor in the sky, there is in fact no leader. The birds move in unison by following rules, like we humans follow road rules. Flocking is an emergent behaviour arising from the rules. In the 1980s, Craig Reynolds, a computer scientist, hypothesised that there are three flocking rules: head in the same direction as your neighbour, move away from nearby birds, and move closer to faraway birds. As rules go, they sound eminently sensible. Reynolds developed a 3D computer model of flocking creatures he named boids that follow these rules. When he ran the model, the boids looked like murmurating starlings. So much so, Reynolds' model was used in the movie Batman Returns to show penguins flocking and bats swarming. Although the movement of the boids might appear authentic, I know that scientists would require more proof before agreeing that Reynolds' rules reflect reality. I start browsing scientific papers, looking for that proof. I learn that in 2005, a group of physicists spent winter nights on the roof of the Palazzo Massimo in Rome, documenting murmurations over the train station. They used multiple cameras, photographing the starlings from different angles. To reconstruct each bird's trajectory, they developed a starling recognition computer program that matched up individual birds in different sets of pictures. The physicists' data show that starling murmurations are more complex than the flocking of boids. Starlings match the speed and direction of the seven starlings nearest to them. This means that a bird 5 metres away in a sparse flock is just as influential as a bird 1 metre away in a dense flock. Why seven, I wonder, when starlings, whose eyes are in the side of their heads, can see 15 to 20 other birds? The more birds each starling tracks, the less chance of the flock breaking up. But it takes brain power, energy, to keep track of another bird, and a murmurating starling also needs to watch out for predators, like falcons, as well as find a warm roosting site for the night. A collaboration of engineers, mathematicians, and the Rome train station physicists worked out that keeping track of seven neighbours optimises the balance between these two competing goals: flock cohesiveness and energy conservation. It seems that starlings have evolved to behave optimally without ever studying maths. Starlings are also songbirds that can sing two notes simultaneously, thanks to their special avian larynx and their accomplished mimics on a par with parrots. Mozart purchased one after hearing it sing the motif from his Piano Concerto No. 17 in G. Although the starling sang one note sharp, a G, it became his beloved pet. But outside their native Europe, starlings are much reviled. They are North America's most hated bird and have been killed with impunity, along with their eggs and nestlings. There is even a specific poison for the task, starlicide. Nevertheless, there are still an estimated 200 million starlings in North America. They purportedly feast on crops and defecate everywhere. They invade the nests of other birds, evicting the owners forcefully. Noah Stryker, a bird watcher famous for seeing more than 6,000 species in a single year, calls starlings rats with wings. Sternus vulgaris is their official name. Sternus means star and could refer to either the bird's star shape when flying or the twinkling white spots that appear on its black feathers during breeding season. Vulgaris means common, not vulgar, as the bird's belittlers might believe. The starling world is turning out to be complex, and I've become convinced that there's much more to discover about murmurations. I email Irene Giardini, one of the Rome train station physicists, who sends me a list of her group's publications. The papers have almost as many equations as words, and it seems that I've forgotten more calculus than I ever knew. Still, I think I get the gist. A murmuration's turns are always initiated by the birds at the elongated tip of the flock. Because every bird's movement is influenced by seven other birds, a change in one bird's speed ripples through the flock, forming the pulses I saw on YouTube. Very soon, all birds are flying at the same velocity as the bird who first sped up or slowed down. When a flock turns in unison, it's like a snowflake melting or water evaporating to steam, what physicists call phase transitions. I'm spending a lot of time online researching starlings, all because I was smitten by 10,000 porcelain replicas. I'm far from their solo fan. Almost 500,000 people flock to see Murmuration Landscape, and the NGV has purchased the work for its collection with crowd-funded money. What drew us all in? The chiaroscuro of the starling's black against the gallery's white walls? The symbolism of the 10,000 birds, which in Chinese culture represents infinity and immortality? Or simply the immensity of the assemblage of small sculptures? A single porcelain starling would likely be of little interest. The assemblage is a crowd magnet. Fun. More is not just different, more is compelling. Other artists have recognised the power of more. Edmond Duval, for example, a potter known for his assemblages of simple, typically white, hand-thrown porcelain pots, which he clusters on shelves, tables, or in customised cabinets. Duval is also the author of the wildly popular memoir, The Hare with the Amber Eyes. It describes his quest for the story of the Netsuki collection he inherited. Netsuki are miniature wood and ivory carvings used in 17th century Japan as toggles to attach objects such as a pipe to the sash of a man's kimono. Duval spent years combing archives as well as walking the streets of London, Paris, Vienna and Japan, where his ancestors once lived. He enjoyed the research but felt guilty about the time it took, time he was not spending throwing pots. He discovered that the relative who purchased the Netsuki was a passionate student of art who deprecated his commitment to learning, then uncool for a rich young man, as vagabonding. Duval decides that he too is vagabonding. It sounds slightly disreputable, but also romantic. Unlike Duval, my research hasn't taken me away from home, but I feel like I've descended into a rabbit warren of starling science, and it's a time sink. Edmond Duval repositioned his guilty pleasure as vagabonding. Designating my forays into starling world likewise sounds like an equally good plan, and I vagabond on. So why do starlings congregate in such large numbers at a roost site, murmurating before they pack themselves, sometimes as densely as 500 birds per cubic metre, into hedges, reed beds and built structures? One theory is that there's warmth in numbers, which is undeniable. But commuting long distances to a roost, as starlings often do, burns up more energy than they save once snuggled up. Roosts are larger when food is scarcer, supporting another theory that starlings come together at night to share information about the location of food. Try thinking about how those starling conversations might go without smiling. If your smile has a sceptical tinge, you might want to check your human exceptionalism, like I have to when I serendipitously come across another de Waal, Franz, and his tauntingly titled book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are? Franz de Waal describes a plethora of observations that demonstrate animals' intelligence and altruism. Chimpanzees who think ahead, farewelling their companions before leaving on a mission, or who jump into a lake to save their kin, even though chimpanzees can't swim. Rats who regret their decisions. Octopuses and crows who recognise human faces, especially mean ones. He argues that we routinely downplay the mental and emotional capacities of animals, assuming that their lack of speech indicates inferior cognition. We often haven't been smart enough to know how smart animals are, and Franz de Waal shines a light on the folly of classifying animals by adding the prefix non to humans, as in non-human primates. Our world is way more than human. In fact, our DNA is so similar to that of chimpanzees that we barely deserve our own genus. As for birds, Franz de Waal describes a parrot named Alex, who was honoured with an obituary in the New York Times because of his extraordinary cognitive skills. Alex was able to add numbers and determine how objects differed from one another, by colour, say. His scientist owner worked in a repressive Russian institute, and Alex would tell her to calm down when she returned, fuming from meetings. Franz de Waal concludes that there's more knocking around in a bird's skull than anyone expected. So, starlings may well be as smart as parrots, smart and altruistic enough to congregate at night to share information about food sources. But research shows that foiling predators is one of their motivations for flocking beforehand. A bird of prey was observed trying to pick off a starling during 1/3 of 3,000 murmurations watched by citizen scientists in 23 countries. Animal behaviourists examined the Rome train station data to investigate how murmurating starlings respond to these attacks. They found that when a falcon attacks at medium speed, waves occur. Human observers see a dark band propagate through the flock. When the attacker comes faster, especially from above, the starlings quickly move outwards. There is a flash expansion, a bit like fireworks. Murmurations are not just mesmerising. They are an example of birds working cleverly together to achieve their individual goal, living to fly another day. And although murmurations are the most visually impressive starling behaviour, there are numerous other examples of their smarts. To research her book, Mozart's Starling, Leander Lynn Hout raised a starling in her home. Named Carmen, the bird began mimicking household sounds, observing the human action that preceded the sound and vocalising her version first. At night, Leander grinds coffee for the next morning. Carmen shouts out ker-clunk before the lid is removed from the coffee jar, making the same sound. Wurrah, says Carmen, before the grinder does. Carmen sounds cute as well as clever, but it is the grammatical skills of her tribe that most impress me. Starlings have the ability to recognise recursive syntax. Susan, who enjoys sketching, is interested in starlings, is recursive, whereas Susan is interested in starlings and enjoys sketching, is not. The capacity to comprehend recursive syntax was thought to be uniquely human. Then starlings were taught to distinguish between recursive starling-generated sounds like rattle, rattle-warble, warble, and non-recursive sequences like rattle-warble, rattle-warble. And yet another skill had to be crossed off the list of purportedly unique human abilities. I'm getting acquainted with the shimmering feathered starling, a bird that humans seem to either love or love to hate, but I feel the need to take my research offline. So I contact Jeff Park a keen bird watcher who documents his sightings on a photography block. He agrees to visit and talk starlings. We sit on my deck looking out at the bush, our conversation punctuated by bird calls that Jeff reflexively identifies. White-throated tree creeper, grey shrike thrush, or colorinkler harmonica, as it is also fittingly known. Jeff is not a starling fan. They're marauders, he says. They eject native birds from their hollow nests, often eating the eggs too. He says starlings were brought to Australia in the 19th century by the acclimatisation societies who wanted to anglicise the landscape. Such societies were active in America too, where starlings were released in New York in order to populate Central Park with every bird mentioned in Shakespeare's works. A starling appears in Henry IV, playing a vengeful role. The rebel Hotspur, angry with King Henry for refusing to pay the ransom for the release of Hotspur's brother-in-law, Mortimer, dreams of gifting the king a starling, specially trained to speak nothing but Mortimer. Starlings have thrived in Australia as well as America because of their marauding, and also because they're indiscriminate eaters and prolific breeders. They were initially confined to the eastern and southeastern seaboards, but have been attempting to cross the Nullarbor Plain to Western Australia, an 1,100-kilometre stretch of arid land. They fly a few kilometres, establish a colony around farmhouses or service stations, breed, then move on. Teams of humans, concerned about likely destruction of the wheat belt if the birds reach Western Australia, have formed shooting parties to halt the migration. Jeff Park agrees that murmurations are impressive. He's seen a small one, but says that other birds exhibit similar flocking behaviour, albeit in far fewer numbers. Musk lorikeets, for example, can fly in formation through the tree canopy, something that starlings, who prefer wide-open spaces, don't, or possibly can't, do. The bush surrounding my home is too dense for starlings, so my neighbourhood birds are spared their marauding. The kookaburras who wake me in the morning, the rainbow lorikeets who fly about looking pretty, the owl who occasionally lands on the rail of my deck during the day looking confused, and that white-throated tree creeper whose piercing whistle Jeff Park identified, can nest in their tree cavities, undisturbed by starlings. I thought there was something primeval about murmurations when I first saw one. And, in fact, there's a school of thought that animal flocking mirrors the less visible sinking of cells that's universal in living creatures. The clumping of skin cells during wound healing and the simultaneous beating of heart cells are, like murmurations, emergent behaviours. The orchestrated response of the immune system to an invading pathogen, and even the cell differentiation that occurs during development of multicellular organisms, may be other examples. Groups of humans in motion have the ability to spontaneously sync up too, a phenomenon I see when my vagabonding takes me back to YouTube. There, I watch a video of protesters in Hong Kong dispersing when police move in. It looks just like the pulsing wave of a starling flock during a falcon attack, and Leander Lynn Hout, Carmen the Starling's owner, describes a visceral response when she watches a murmuration. Her head swirls, her body sways. She speculates that her response may arise from an unconscious identification with the same movements at work in the neurons of my own brain and neural synapses, deep calling unto deep, as the psalmist sang. Our growing understanding of flocking and synchronization has found multiple practical applications. In animation, including video games and movies such as The Lion King, which includes a wildebeest stampede. In art, such as the iridescent drones programmed to swarm in the Miami Beach night sky during a fair. And in aerospace, such as the US Air Force's plans for a system of formation flying satellites that can adapt to changed mission requirements. Myriad further applications are mooted. One that I particularly like relates to the deep sea, the next frontier for scientists. Its exploration is challenging for many reasons, one being that GPS doesn't work underwater. However, communication between exploratory sensors is possible via acoustic signals, and a murmuration-based protocol has been proposed for clustering such sensors, thereby markedly expanding the scope of exploration. There's something poetic in scientists drawing inspiration from birds to explore water too deep for fish to swim in. Starlings murmurate to survive. Their moves bring joy to the people lucky enough to be watching. Some of these people get out their phones, press record, and then share those videos with people on the other side of the world. They share the joy. Artists like Sai Guoshung feel inspired. Scientists like the Rome train station physicists become curious. Mathematicians try to solve equations that describe the instances in the more-than-human world where living things self-organize and synchronize. Engineers and entrepreneurs try to understand the connections between these instances. Starlings flocking, fish swarming, fireflies flashing simultaneously, the cells of the sinoatrial node commanding the heart to beat, audiences clapping in unison. And people like me, spurred by a sketching session underneath an installation of ceramic birds, start vagabonding.